come up here and play two or three more if you want. But. So, good afternoon, everyone. I thought it would be appropriate to take a minute and let you know that Aaron made it home Wednesday night late, and it turns out she didn't really have a blockage per se in the sense of the way I was thinking anyway. I guess because of all the surgeries she had had in the past, scar tissue had formed like strings around her intestine and choked them off that way. So actually the operation involved them going in laparoscopically and removing the scar tissue, which means they didn't have to do anything with cutting in the bowel, and which would have brought a lot of problems in itself. So she is hopeful that she won't be bothered with future blockages and problems in that area. So we appreciate your prayers. She's still weak. Darlene spent Thursday and Friday with her, and we'll go down next week. And she has her hands full with three young children, as you might know. So she still needs your prayers and help, and we appreciate all that she has received. When I was young, I think I was young, I'm starting to forget, in school and in society, we were told, stand up for what's right. I remember things like, be brave. Even if you're alone, stand up for the right, the poor, the helpful, the helpless. TV and movies tended to tell stories of people who, in spite of great odds and certain death in some instances, stood for what was right, defending the weak and the poor, children and little puppies, and even women, which now we are not allowed to, because if you hold the door, that's evidently wrong, but that's another topic altogether. We were told stories about people like Davy Crockett and Jim Bowie, who gave their lives for the country that they believed in, of sacrifices of those in wartime that gave their lives for a way of life, stories of men and women and children, seniors and young and old alike, who unselfishly gave their life to save another person's life. We were told that even those who had broken the law or was accused of doing wrong deserved our protection to help them go through what was called, or what is called, due process until they had their day in court to also prove their innocence or guilt. I remember hearing stories of heroes who, in spite of great odds and certain death, stood for what was right and good. I remember hearing about the evil Hitler and others who caused millions of deaths, and how evil he was and what he stood for, and that we should always be a voice of reason and not allow that to happen around us at any time. Now today, however, we are bombarded with, take care of yourself. Let others worry about other people. You just worry about yourself. After all, there are social programs that help the elderly, that help, you know, little kids and so forth. Don't worry about it. It's taken care of. TV and movies tell us that we are to destroy those who oppose us. And even our schools no longer teach what they used to refer to as the Golden Rule, which we know involve godly principles. Now we hear phrases like, you deserve a break today. And you must take care of yourself. Reward yourself. We're told that today that you're the most important person that we are. And sometimes, and usually it's someone else's job instead of our own. We even in religion, we like to say things like, well, somebody else's job. Let them do it. Today, brethren, we're going to look at a subject that we should all relate to. Can one person make a difference? I would like for us to begin in the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel 22 in verse 30. Ezekiel 22 in verse 30, where we read, so I sought for a man among them who would make a wall and stand in the gap before me on behalf of the land, that I should not destroy it, but I found no one. If you look at the Hebrew for these scriptures, it says that God says he looked for a man to stand face to face with him, to him, to save the people of the land from being destroyed for their evil ways. But he could not find one person to stand in the gap or to put themselves in a position of saving people, sinful as though they may be. God does not enjoy punishing us, even though we deserve it at times. And he wants us or someone to stand up and give him a reason so that he doesn't have to create and bring about punishments, just like Abraham and Moses did. Let's turn over to Genesis. Genesis 18. For our next scripture, we'll read about Abraham first. Genesis chapter 18, we're all familiar with this, so I'll just kind of skim it. It's talking about when, remember the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, and how the angels and the personage who became Jesus Christ, the Lord, came to Abraham because Sodom and Gomorrah was to be destroyed. And as the story goes on down through this chapter, he talks about how Abraham stood before him. And as far as the Hebrew goes, it says he stood in his face. I'm sure that didn't mean in a negative way. Obviously, Abraham was very respectful of God. He had a good relationship with the Lord. And Abraham starts bargaining, it sounds like anyway, with him, saying, well, what if there's 50 righteous in there? Are you going to destroy everyone because of the 50 righteous? I mean, aren't you going to save them all? And he said, sure, okay, if there's 50 righteous, I won't destroy it. And he goes on down, and you can read down through these scriptures, as I'm sure you have before, where in verse 32 we find him saying, well, just bear with me a little more, God. What if there's only 10? Will you save it then? And God says, yes, if there's 10, I'll save the city. So I wonder why he stopped the 10. Did you ever think about that? This is a little aside, I suppose. But if you turn over to the 19 and verse 12, it talks about, just right on over the next page in my Bible, it says in verse 12, then the man said to Lot, have you anyone else here, son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, and whomever you have in the city, take them out of this place. For we will destroy this place because of the outcry that has come up great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who had married his daughters. Remember, he had two daughters unmarried that lived in his home with him. So there's at least two, because it's in the plural. Could have been more. And said, get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city. But to his sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking. And when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city. So counting, there's Lot and his wife, his two daughters, and at least two other daughters and their husbands. And there could have been a third daughter and another husband, or even maybe some children, grandchildren. So I think that maybe Abraham, knowing this, that's why he stopped at 10. He didn't need to go any further because that covered those that he thought that may be able to be saved in Sodom. I don't know. I guess we'll find out one day, but I thought that was very interesting that Abraham was willing to stand before the God of the universe and say, wait a minute. Why would you kill them for if there's innocent people there? He wasn't afraid to stand in the gap. Let's turn over to Exodus 32 for our next scripture. In Exodus 32, beginning in verse 7. Exodus 32, beginning in verse 7. And the Lord said to Moses, go, get down, for your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made themselves a molded calf and worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. And the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people. Indeed, they are stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone, and my wrath burn hot against them, that I may consume them, and I will make of you a great nation. Wouldn't that be tempting? I mean, he was going to take Moses and make a nation out of him. That would have been a temptation that some people would have fallen into. Then Moses pleaded with the Lord, his God, and said, Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt? And the Hebrew says here, he stood in at his face in front of him, and he talked to him. The great power with your great power and your mighty hand. Why should the Egyptians speak and say, he brought them out to harm them, to kill them in the mountains, and to consume them from the face of the earth? So he's reasoning here with God, the all-powerful being and the creator of the universe. Turn from your fierce wrath and relent from this harm to your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore your own self and said to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and all of this land that I have spoken I will give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. So the Lord relented from the harm which he said that he would do to his people. He stood in the gap. He stood before God and he said, no, you can't do this. Turn on over a little later in the same chapter. And we read in verse 30. It's still in the same chapter, chapter 32, verse 30. And it came to pass on the next day that Moses said to the people, you have sinned a great sin, and now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make an atonement for your sin. Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, oh, these people have sinned a great sin and have made for themselves a god of gold. Yet now, if you will forgive their sin, but if not, I pray, blot me out of your book. We understand that to be the book of life which you have written. So Moses said, yes, they sin. They're guilty. Please forgive them, but if you can't forgive them, blot me out too. And God just previously had said, I'll make a great nation of you. He handed him the world, you might say. But Moses stood in the gap for the people. They didn't deserve it, did they? But he made the difference. Moses was a friend of God, and before him he was willing to be blotted out for the people that he stood to God. Now you might be thinking, yes, but back then they were stronger, they were braver. They didn't have all these laws like we do against violence, and you can really get in trouble for it. And they didn't have a car, and I don't know what that has to do with it anyway. And at times, they were different, it just wasn't the same as the Old Testament. And you might think, how can one person really make a difference? I mean, what if you're against the whole world? What if you're against everyone in your neighborhood? What if someone is accusing a fellow brethren, or maybe just your neighbor, and maybe he's not the greatest guy in the world, but they come over to lynch him? Are you willing to stand in the gap? How can you even measure how one person can make a difference? Well, I'm glad you asked that. I would like to tell you about an experiment that was first done in 1961. Those in Prestonsburg have to bear with me because I used this example one other time. It's been repeated several times since then, and to my knowledge, the last time that it was done, it was aired on the Discovery Channel, October the 30th, 2011, under the title, How Evil Are You? By Eli Roth. The Milgram experiment was an experiment to try to study the obedience to authority figures and was a series of done with a series of notable social psychological experiments conducted by Yale University psychologist Stanley Milgram, which measured the willingness and to the study of the participants to obey an authority figure who instructed them to perform acts that conflicted with their personal conscience. They ran an ad in the paper back in 61 and offered $4 for an hour of your time. In 61, $4 was quite a bit of money for an hour. They ended up experimenting with 1,000 different people, but they did it in groups of 40. The experiments began in July 1961, and Milgram devised his psychological study to answer the question, during the Holocaust, in World War II. At this point, it was just 6 years prior to that. Were only the leaders of Nazi Germany responsible for the atrocities, or were all of the soldiers under their orders, and even the townspeople around the death camps who supplied the camps, in some cases, some of them even worked in the camps for profit, were they responsible for all of the tortures and the deaths and the cremations that took place in the camps as well as the Nazis? In other words, was there a mutual sense of morality among those involved? Milgram's testing suggested that it could have been that millions of accomplices were merely following orders despite violating their deepest moral beliefs. In the experiment, there were three participants. The experimenter was the person who gave the test and he gave the orders. The teacher, who was really the person being studied in the test, without his knowledge, of course. And there was a learner who was known as a Confederate. He was actually an actor. The volunteer subject was given the role of teacher. And the Confederate was given the role of the learner. The participants drew slips of paper to determine their roles, but unknown to the subject, both slips said teacher. And the actor claimed to have the slip that read learner, thus guaranteeing that the participant would always be the teacher. At this point, the teacher and the learner would be separated into different rooms where they could communicate with one another, but they couldn't see each other. There was a wall between them. In one version of the experiment, the Confederate was sure to mention to the participant that he had a heart condition. So to begin with, they hooked the teacher up to a small electric shock from an electroshock generator to show them that it was really, they really had electricity they were using. The teacher was then given a list of word pairs which he was to teach the learner. The teacher began by reading the list of word pairs. And the teacher then would read the first word of the word pairs and read four possible answers. The learner would press a button to indicate his response. If the answer was incorrect, the teacher would administer a shock to the learner. With the voltage increasing in 15-volt increments, all the way up to 450 volts for each wrong answer. If he got the answer correct, the teacher would read the next word pair. The subjects believed that for each wrong answer, the learner was receiving actual shocks. In reality, there were no more shocks, except that initial one with the teacher to let him think that they were being shocked. After the Confederate was separated from the subject, the Confederate set up a tape recorder integrated with the electroshock generator, which played pre-recorded sounds for each shock level. After a number of voltage level increases, the actor started banging on the wall and moaning. And after several times, he started complaining that his heart was bothering him. Well, at this point, many people indicated their desire to stop the experiment and check on the learner. Some test subjects paused at 135 volts and began to question the purpose of the experiment. Most continued after being assured that they would not be held personally responsible. A few subjects began to laugh nervously or exhibit other signs of extreme stress once they heard the screams of pain coming from the learner. If any time the subject indicated his desire to halt the experiment, he was given a succession of verbal prods by the experimenter in this order. First, he was told, "Please continue." Then the experimenter would say, "You are required to continue." Thirdly, he would say, "It is absolutely essential that you continue." And then finally, he would say, "You have no choice. You must go on." If the subject still wished to stop, after all four successive verbal prods, the experiment then was halted. Otherwise, It was halted after the subject had given the maximum 450-volt shock three successive times. The experimenter also gave special prods if the teacher made specific comments. If the teacher asked whether the learner might suffer permanent physical harm, the experimenter replied, "Although the shocks may be painful, there is no permanent tissue damage. So please go on." If the teacher said that the learner learner clearly wants to stop, the experimenter replied, "Whether the learner likes it or not, you must go on until he has learned all of the word pairs. Please go on." Results? In the Milgram's first set of experiments in 1961, remember they're in groups of 40, 65%, 26 out of 40, participants went on to the final massive 450-volt shock three times. Though many were very comfortable doing so, at some point, every participant paused and questioned the experiment. Some said they would refund the money that they were paid for participating in the experiment. Milgram surmised the experiment in his 1974 article, The Perils of Obedience, writing this: "The legal and the philosophic aspects of obedience are of enormous importance, but they say very little about how most people behave in concrete situations. I set up a simple experiment at Yale University to test how much pain an ordinary citizen would inflict on another person simply because he was ordered to by an experimental scientist. Stark authority was pitted against the subject's participants' strong morality, against hurting others, and with the subject's participants' ears ringing with the screams of the victims, authority won more often than not. The extreme willingness of adults to go to almost any lengths on the command of an authority constitutes the chief finding of the study, and the fact most urgently demanding explanation. Ordinary people, simply doing their jobs, and without any particular hostility on their part, can become agents in a terrible destructive process. Moreover, even when the destructive effects of their work become very clear, and they are asked to carry out actions that are incompatible with their fundamental beliefs and morality, relatively few people have the resources needed to resist the authority figure. Dr. Thomas Blass of the University of Maryland in Baltimore County performed a meta-analysis of the other doctor's results on the results and repeated performances of the experiment. He found that the percentage of participants who prepared to inflict the fatal voltages remains remarkably constant at 61 to 66%, regardless of time and place. None of the participants who refused to administer the final shocks insisted that the experiment itself be terminated, nor left the room to check on the health of the victim. The whole experiment was designed to see if ordinary Americans would obey immoral orders, as many Germans had done during the Nazi period. Some of the interpretations from the experiment, Professor Milgram elaborated two theories explaining his results. The first is a theory of conformatism. A person who has neither ability nor expertise to make decisions, especially in time of crisis, will leave decision-making to a group and its hierarchy. The group is the person's behavioral model. In other words, he won't make up his own mind. He lets someone else do it for him. The second is the agentic state theory, wherein the essence of obedience consists in the fact that a person comes to view themselves as the instrument of carrying out another person's wishes. And they, therefore, no longer see themselves as responsible for their actions. Once this critical shift of viewpoint has occurred in a person, all of the essential features of obedience will follow. People learn that when experts tell them something, like, it's okay, it's all right. It probably is, even if everything points to maybe it isn't. They did other variations of the experiment. You know how animal lovers are so soft and gentle and they wouldn't hurt a fly. Well, in one of the experiments, they used a live, cute little puppy who was given real, albeit harmless, electric shocks. Similar findings were found. I found this very interesting. Half of the male subjects and all of the females obeyed to the end. Many subjects showed high levels of distress during the experiment, and some openly wept, but they went on. The only change was that the duration for which a shock button was pressed decreased as the shocks got higher. So instead of holding it down and letting them fry for a minute, they would just barely touch it. So they at least did that much. In experiment 8, ladies, they used only women, where before they had used men. All the participants had been men before, but now they're all women. The obedience did not significantly differ, though the women communicated that they had higher levels of stress. It was still 2/3 hit the kill button. In the 2011 Discovery Channel, How Evil Are You?, they found some interesting statistics. This is 50 years after the first experiment. In 1961, 1/3 stopped the test before it was completed. Before they completed it, 66% went on all the way to the 450 volt three times. In 2011, less than 1/4 stopped. 77% went all the way. Are we any better than those people, than those Germans in World War II? Today in America, researchers tell us that the environment of the nation is low empathy, high aggression, and selfishness. And this is a combination that says that they say any mid-sized American town would act the very same way as the townspeople of the German towns that surrounded the death camps, and would act with the same degree of carelessness for anyone in a camp next to their homes, and would be an employee or even give supplies to the death camp as they did in World War II. In the experiment, the teacher was told that he could quit any time, and he could even keep the money. They were told that at the very beginning. They had to answer the 4 questions, but then they could quit, walk away with $4 in their pocket. But that didn't make any difference. He was also told that the learner had a heart condition. As the voltage increased, the learner would cry out in pain more and more. He would bang on the walls and scream, "Please, no more, I can't take it." But that didn't make any difference to 2/3. Later, 3/4. He would cry out that his chest hurt, but the voltage continued all the way up to 450 volts, 3 times, even though at a lower voltage prior to that, the sound stopped altogether. So as far as the guy knew, as far as they knew, the person was already dead, but they kept administering the voltages. So here's the main point, to the effects of peer pressure, of standing in the gap. In the 61 test, Milgram also combined the effect of authority with that of conformity. In those experiments, the participant was joined by 1 or 2 additional teachers, also actors. The behavior of the participants with peer pressure strongly affected the results with just 1 other person. In experiment number 17, additional teachers refused to comply with the orders to go ahead to the end, which caused the person being experimented on and being tested to only go to the end with 4 out of 40. So 1 person made that much difference, just saying, "No, this is wrong, don't do it." Then conversely, in experiment 18, the teacher was for the test and said, "Yes, it's okay, go ahead, you should do this." 37 went all the way to the end out of 40. One person being there telling the teacher to either go ahead or don't go ahead made a difference. So the one who refused to go along caused 90% of the teachers to stop hurting another person. And the one who went along with it caused 93% of the teachers to continue to the maximum 450 volts three times. Brethren, this is scientific proof, at least to me and hopefully to you, that one person truly can make a difference. Let's turn to 2 Timothy. Second Timothy chapter 1. Beginning in verse 7. For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of sound mind. Therefore, do not be ashamed of the testimony of our Lord, nor of me as prisoner, but share with me in the sufferings for the gospel according to the power of God. The gospel according to the partaker of the afflictions of the gospel according to the power of the God. I looked up the Greek for that, and in the Greek it says, the Greek means the partaker of the affliction of the gospel is to suffer hardships together with someone through Christ's second great commandment of love of man, strengthened with the power of God. Turn over to 1 Peter 2, please, our last scripture. 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning in verse 19. 1 Peter 2:19. For this is commendable if because of conscience towards God one endures grief and suffering wrongfully. For what credit is it when you are beaten of your faults that you take it patiently, but when you do good and suffer for it, which standing in the gap for someone else is doing good, and you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. Verse 21. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that we should follow in his footsteps. Abraham, Moses, Jesus Christ, and there's other examples that I could have gone to, but I thought those three were heady enough to use, showed us how to stand in the gap. We all need to stand in the gap and not fear the death of the body, but the one that can destroy the soul. Conclusion. Brethren, times are tough and they will get tougher. God tells us that there will be false accusations made against the brethren. Will you make the difference and stand in the gap before the Lord and say, no, this is wrong? Will you be able to trust God and do what is right? Even though you have fear, do it through fear. Will I be able to? I have to ask myself the same question. Today we have seen from the Bible how Abraham, Moses, and Jesus all gave us example of standing in the gap, of making a difference, of laying down their lives for others and for right. We have also seen scientific proof that one person can truly make the difference in a given situation. Let's remember that regardless of age, gender, or education, that one person can truly make a difference, that no matter what the circumstances is, we must always remember that I can make a difference.